Paul says, always rejoice. And the word he uses there is the same word which is used for grace, same root.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
By grace you are saved by faith, and this not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. That's square one. And then Paul goes on to say, pray without ceasing and give thanks. Those all belong together. Rejoice, pray, and give thanks, all under the grace of Christ. The result is a deep joy.
You can meet and hear President Matt Harrison making the case for being joyfully Lutheran at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. The one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It seems that politically nowadays, everything is modified by the adjective universal. Universal health care, universal college tuition, universal daycare or child care. What does it mean? And what kind of a political philosophy lies behind the calls for these things, the plans for these things, especially the one about child care? Because child care is, well, traditionally, the task of mothers and fathers. How do we get to the point where we have politicians credibly calling for essentially the state to raise our children most of the hours of the day, or at least the state to pay for the raising of our children for most of the hours of the day? Joining us to talk about universal daycare, Joy Pullman, managing editor of The Federalist and author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled, Children Don't Need Daycare for All, They Need Their Mothers. Joy, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
So what is usually meant, or what is typically nowadays meant by this term, universal child care?
Well, it basically means birth through the entrance into school of government-subsidized daycare. There are right now a couple of plans might be too strong of a word, but ideas by some of the presidential candidates on the Democratic side for this sort of thing, including Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. So Elizabeth Warren's plan basically suggests that every family at 200% of the federal poverty level, which is most of the families in the country, I mean the vast majority, 80% of them at least, would basically have taxpayer dollars paying for their children, you know, from basically birth until they enter school to be placed in an out-of-home situation so the mom can work.
Why do you say that this amounts to nationalized, even socialized daycare?
Well, because it's a federally proposed program. So, I mean, of course, so it's not something proposed at the state or the local level, or obviously at a private level. You know, it is intended to be a national, federally created, overseen, funded entitlement program for tiny children.
You were recently a panelist on National Public Radio's On Point radio program. What did you learn in that conversation?
Well, it was kind of like being in the Twilight Zone, to be honest. So I was on with a couple of other ladies, academics, and I told the producer afterwards, that was really fun, 3-on-1, because the host, as well as the two other panelists, were obviously in support of having the federal government oversee the raising of children. So it was a wild world in which people... I mean, I don't want to speak, of course, about the ladies. I don't know their situations, but it sounded, I often in these situations wonder how much experience, you know, have they really had with small children and families? Because as longtime listeners know, I have 5 small kids. So that's a pretty intense introduction to the world of small children. And just the ways that people talk about them, including on that program, seem completely separated from the reality of what it's like to be taking care of those little children. As well as, I mean, I've had friends who have worked in daycares, who currently work in daycares. And I, you know, having heard from them the stories of what it's like, I wonder if the people at the policy level, such as those other guests and the callers, and the mothers and people who are demanding for this sort of thing, which are a minority. But I wonder if they have any actual tangible experience with what the typical daycare situation is like. I really don't think they can. Either that or they've hardened their hearts to what, you know, what it really is like.
You say that the call for universal child care is actually driven by father abandonment. Explain what you mean.
Well, that really is because most American women, and particularly mothers of small children, you know, five and under, do not want to be working. Even the majority of women who are currently working full-time, mothers, not women, but mothers who are working full-time in America, the most of them wish that they did not have to work full-time. And the reason, of course, that mothers are pressured into doing that when they'd rather be spending most of their energies developing their children's lives is because, you know, of the breakdown of the family, particularly marriage and father abandonment in our culture. So, you know, that obviously, you know, if you don't have a daddy who is capable, who is willing to stick around to take help his wife support and nurture the children they've created together, you know, then you have pressure on the mother to step in and fill that gap. So if somebody isn't providing food, clothes, you know, toys for kids in the family, you know, typically, I mean, of course, not always. I mean, I'm a working mother. I choose to work, you know, so there's, of course, situations for mostly white-collar women like me. We have opportunities, but the vast majority of full-time working mothers in this country wish that, you know, they didn't have to be pressured into that situation. So it's a lack in the family, in the family structure. There's a lack there that's pushing them to do something they don't think is best for their family.
So with about a minute here, and we can pick it up on the other side of the break, begin to make the case that the best people to raise a child are his or her parents.
It's very hard to me at first to do that because it's so intuitively obvious, but especially as a mother. And as I became a mother, I had never known anything about basic biology, you know, really, you know, you hear the facts of life or whatever, you know, but they don't tell you anything about in sex ed or, you know, biology class about all the wonderful, amazing things that a mother's body does for her baby during pregnancy and after birth. The mom and the baby are intimately linked. You know, the mother is basically the baby's bridge to the entire world, physically, emotionally, psychologically. And so, of course, for the baby to mature in the first place, he is utterly dependent on his mother to create those connections and to develop his sense of individuality, his safety, and all of that. So being with mother constantly is so important for little people. And by little people, I mean under five, under six, under 10. You know, little small children need their mothers to help them learn how to be human beings. And when we don't have mothers, then we have sad kids, depressed kids, emotionally disturbed kids, nervous kids. And we're seeing all of that. You know, those sorts of psychological and emotional problems are rampant in our society. And I think it's because, not solely, of course, but it's partially influenced by mother abandonment.
Joy Pullman is our guest. We're talking about universal child care. She's managing editor of The Federalist. When we come back, what does the research show about the effects of institutionalizing our children? It's time to register to vote for the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Each congregation or multi-point parish must register their pastor and lay voters with the LCMS Office of Secretary by Sunday, March 24th of 2019. A nomination form has been mailed to every LCMS congregation. Learn more at issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident. issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Who is your neighbor? And what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? This February, the Lutheran Witness is exploring what it looks like when Lutherans show God's love to neighbors in need. Highlights include one church's dramatic account of weathering Hurricane Michael and the profile of an LCMS-recognized service organization serving the poorest of the poor in rural Appalachia. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Music. We're talking about universal child care. Joy Pullman of The Federalist is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. You'll hear great Christianity and culture presentations at the one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat on Christians in the Public Square, National Review columnist Wesley Smith on the Hippocratic Oath, Chronicles magazine columnist Aaron Wolf on conservatism, and more. Making the Case is Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Early bird registration is $115. That includes three meals. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Joy, when it comes to the effects of this warehousing of our children, what does the research show?
You'll hear different things from the mass media than I'm about to say. So I'm also going to make an argument for why the research that I cite is of better quality than the ones that you'll hear floated about. So the truth is that the best quality studies on the most numbers of children find that the longer that children spend away from their mothers and at younger ages, the more emotional and academic problems they tend to have. So there have been two what they call gold standard studies done on large-scale preschool and daycare programs. And gold standard means it's the highest quality study that we know how to make, which is random assignment, which means rather than, you know, people applying to a program and they all get in and you just study the ones in versus people who weren't in, what you do is you say, you know, you have 100 slots, 200 people want to be in. So you randomly pick the 100 who get to be in and you study both that 100 and the 100 who wanted to, but the only difference between them and the participating group is that they were allowed to be in the program they wanted. So it basically, you know, shows you the only difference between, you know, these kids is that, you know, some of them got to do this thing and the other ones didn't. So that really helps you have a higher amount of reliability on the studies. So that has been done with Tennessee's preschool program, early child care program that was rolled out there, I think about 20 years ago, as well as another about 20 years ago also in Quebec. The government there rolled out universal child care. So little babies from 6 weeks old all the way till the time that they entered school, government subsidized their care. Their mothers chose to use it. So from this, as well as the federal Head Start program, which is a federal program, it's called preschool, but it also reaches down to toddlers, 3 years old, 4 years old, kids sometimes are using this program. Those three studies have been done on more than 100,000 children across 20 years of time, and all of them found negative effects on the children who participated. Particularly in Quebec, there was, in fact, the most surprising or striking, perhaps, thing that was found about the studies in Quebec was an increase in crime among the children who participated in the daycare program versus the children who did not. But it's been a pretty consistent finding over time that there's a host of problems exhibited by kids who are away from their mothers for longer periods of time in these programs. They include a lot of aggression, so particularly in boys, behavioral problems, not willing to listen. There's also been some documented effects on the entire family, not just the child, but also it's been shown to degrade parenting quality. So parents who are away from their kids more during the week are less patient with their kids. They're more irritated by them. They don't have good parenting skills. So, you know, when they're with their child, they haven't learned how to manage a certain problem that their child does because, you know, they haven't probably, to go from my own experience, they haven't gotten so frustrated with it that they decided that this has to end and we are going to address this no matter what it takes. It's pretty well established. I mean, I would say in my read on the research, the best quality research that we have shows long term. And we're not just talking about these effects on kids in third grade, you know, when they're 8 years old, 9 years old, but these effects were shown to persist all the way into the children's adulthood. The children were more moody than others, so on and so forth. So there's just a number of things that have come out of these studies, you know, that show it really does affect little children not to be with their mothers, which is, of course, anyone with a brain and a heart would, surmise, you know, from just thinking about it for a couple of minutes.
So why do we often hear that daycare has practically no ill effects on children?
Well, that's because, I mean, so it's the studies that I just talked about have been also complicated by a lot more, I'm putting this in air quotes that, of course, listeners can't see, studies done by other people basically that are of a much lower quality and very lower sample size, and typically the ones that show no effects on kids or no long-term effects or sometimes even positive effects, typically on academics. Those are done on literally, 73 children, programs that were very small boutique programs treating highly disadvantaged kids whose parents were almost, to the level of abusing them at home. So what they were getting at home was way worse than what they would get in a center, even if a center's kind of sterile. It's better than being not fed or hit or screamed at or stuck in front of a TV all day. People will go, in the media and say, oh, well, the research is mixed, or the research overwhelmingly says, that daycare is perfectly fine for kids, and sometimes it even helps them academically. But what I think they're really doing is obfuscating, and they're not giving people the results of the highest quality and the largest number of research. And I think that's because there's an emotional agenda entailed with that, as well as a political agenda. And of course, the emotional one is that as moms, I'll just speak for mothers since I'm not a father, but we all have guilt as parents about what we've done with our children, what we've not done with our children. We have all made bad choices when parenting our kids. And rather than repenting or admitting them or being able to live with that and say, Jesus saves my children, Jesus saves me, His grace is sufficient for both of us, and instead we try to cover up the guilt, with lies. We lie to ourselves and we want to lie to other people to pretend that we're really not sinners and that we haven't made mistakes. So I think that's part of the emotional component there. But of course, then there's a political opponent, and there's a large, large contingency of special interest groups. Big business interests, would love to have more ready, cheap female workers who don't have to think about the costs of childcare because, it's been socialized and taxpayers are shouldering the burden rather than individual families using those services. There's also people who have political interests in separating children from families because children who are separated from families are more easily used as political pawns. It's the case that every time you create a government program, you have people who are dependent on it. And so when people are dependent, they're vulnerable. And then you've kind of, the people who are in control of that program have control over those people politically. There's all kinds of reasons that people would want to not tell the actual truth and the best information to families about, what's really going on with these sorts of arrangements for children.
Does that help explain why some policy and lawmakers are so invested in essentially, some of them actually come out and say it, that the state would do a better job of separating children from their parents?
That's right. I was so astonished when I was on NPR while I heard a panelist essentially say what really helps the universal daycare cause is people, American society, getting away from the notion that being cared for privately is good for children. I was so astonished. I grabbed, my notes that I was using, to talk on the radio and wrote down the quote as quickly as I could. Because I couldn't believe that someone would actually say that about families. But there are people who explicitly will say they think it is good to separate families because, this sounds crazy to me, and so I feel like saying it can't be possibly true, but I have seen, the quotes of people who say this. These are academics, researchers, even in political operatives who, say it. We want to, mess up the good families because, well, it's not fair for some children to have bad families, so let's make all families equally bad. They don't say it in those terms, of course. They say it, in the way that I suggested earlier. But that's really the outcome. It's the kind of a deranged notion of, equality, trying to hurt the children who have good environments, which is going to do nothing for the kids who are in bad environments.
So you say that and you have to explain what the Overton window is, not everyone's familiar with it, that the Overton window is being pushed hard left on this issue. What do you mean by that?
So the Overton window theory is just basically this idea that there is kind of a range of what is considered politically possible, what is socially acceptable, kind of determines what is politically possible to do. I think a really good example of this was kind of the cascade effect that happened when the Supreme Court nationalized gay marriage with the Obergefell decision in 2015. Before that, we had just had a couple of years before that, President Obama and Hillary Clinton, the contender for the 2016 Democrat nomination, saying in public that they thought marriage should be between a man and a woman. This was, it was majorities of society accepted that. And very soon after the Supreme Court nationalized gay marriage, that decision that was, right on the edge of what was considered acceptable, switched the entire conception among the society of what was possible. The people, the public opinion shifted from being largely against it to being largely for it in just a breakneck pace within a decade. And so, and then we saw hitting hard on the heels of that all this wild transgender stuff. So the point of that is that when people propose or go out to the fringe and propose what you and I and our listeners would think of as crazy things, infanticide, literally, you know, delivering a live human baby, you know, after birth, and then deciding whether it's going to continue to live or whether they're going to execute it, you know, after the birth. That's a crazy thing. You know, 90% of Americans more, you know, don't think that's a good idea. But by people saying that and having it be one side of the spectrum, that it reframes what is considered the moderate or the middle of the road position. So to bring all of that, you know, so then all of a sudden, it's just moderate to say, oh, well, let's just limit abortion to before the babies are viable, instead of, you know, saying humans are all humans from the point of conception, so on and so forth. So if you apply it to these kind of family programs that we're discussing, I think a lot of the times people who are on the far left, who are literal socialists and literal communists, what they do is by having, when they're, you know, mainstreamed, when they stand up and are not ashamed or embarrassed to say they're a socialist or communist, when those are ideologies that have, you know, enslaved and mass murdered literally hundreds of millions of people in world history, what it does is, you know, makes people more amenable to really, really terrible ideas. So, you know, if people stand up and say, politicians, oh, look, you know, we should have an entitlement program, you know, basically, you know, centers for children that are not with their families, you know, 6 weeks, pop that little newborn, you know, into a stranger's arms. People take their cues from other people saying things. So the people who say the craziest stuff, they might not get all the mothers in the country, you know, taking their 6 week olds and putting them with another person that the baby doesn't know. But they will get more people doing that. They'll get more people putting their kids into such programs earlier, and they'll get more political support among quote unquote moderates, which on both sides of the political aisle, for doing what is considered a compromise situation, such as having government pay for only quote-unquote only, right now only, a couple of years of, you know, child care, or only, you know, a tax credit, or only for this, only for that. And of course, inevitably, I mean, historically, every single one of those onlys always, it never stays at only, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Finally then, make the case that marriage is the real solution, stable marriage is the real solution for what everyone acknowledges are the problems and the challenges of raising children.
Well, it's really, really hard to raise little children, probably any children. I don't have big children yet, so I can't speak to that. But I have a lot of little children, and they are exhausting. And, you know, and it's a full-time job to care for their needs. It really is. It's probably more than a full-time job. And so, but the society needs children, right? You know, we need a next generation. This used to be accepted. It's crazy that I would even have to establish the fact that, you know, we need children. Children are a good in and of themselves. People should have them. So if you accept as given that children are good and people should have them, well, then, you know, you should also say, well, children should be cared for well, right? We shouldn't treat them like garbage. We shouldn't treat them like they're expendable. We shouldn't basically create a child library where parents check out their kids like books, you know, for a couple of hours at night or on the weekends. Families should mean something. So if you accept that as a preposition, then you have to think about, okay, well, what do kids need? Well, they need money and they need care. And so marriage has been historically the arrangement by which, you know, basically the daddy traded his money, his labor, his protection, and his physical economic care for the wife's nurturing, child raising, you know, family development, home development care. And, you know, because people are more efficient at the things that they specialize in. And I know this because my husband and I switch off all the time, and there's lots of transaction costs to doing that. It is much more efficient. And typically people are happier when, you know, one of the spouses focus on, you know, either the family or the marketplace. So, I mean, and people have done this for centuries because it works. It's effective and makes people happy. And, you know, the social science is unanimous on this. Very, very resoundingly clear, you know, that what is best, 100% no comparison for children is to be living with their own married biological parents and, you know, to be raised by them exclusively. And so, I mean, I think it is imperative upon all of us who know that, both intuitively and intellectually, to be making the case for that publicly, because it relieves women of the pressure to have to be, you know, forced into doing things that we don't want to do, that we know intuitively in our hearts. You know, they don't make us happy. They don't make our kids happy. They don't even make our husbands happy. You know, we don't have to be men to have validation and worth in society, you know, because it is highly important. It is a treasure that we are bequeathing to our country by doing a good job raising our children who don't have emotional problems, who are going to be self-controlled, contributing adults, who are going to love their neighbors and serve them and worship God. And so, you know, the more that we say that and the more that we practice it, that's the way that we create a culture that values that and protects children and helps them to have a good life.
Joy Pullman is managing editor of The Federalist. She's author of the book, The Education Invasion, and a recent column titled, Children Don't Need Daycare for All, They Need Their Mothers. You can read her columns and purchase The Education Invasion at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Joy, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the new science about DNA that challenges evolution with biochemist Dr. Michael Behe. We'll get a review of the movie Glass with Pastor Ted Geese. We'll also play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.